This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
Are you the brain specialist? No! No, I am not the brain specialist! No! No, I am not! Yes! Yes, I am! My brain hurts! Well, let's take a look at it, Mr. Gumby!
Well, we go from Monty Python's Flying Circus and the brain specialists about to look into somebody's brain into where we really are of any brain problems until something bad happens. But that's what Brain Awareness Day is to do, is to help bring you up to date in thinking about the importance of your brain and the importance of using your brain properly in all sorts of ways. Purdue University Northwest is offering this to be available on the Westville campus at the Library Student Faculty Building on Tuesday. With us to talk about it, we have Professor Christina Reagan and Liz Burnell, who is with the University Art Collections and the Special Events Program at the Purdue University Northwest campus. Ladies, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, how important is it to know more about our brains?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And for one, I think all of us know probably at least one person who is either suffering from mental illness or, you know, a grandparent with Alzheimer's. So we all know someone who may be affected by neurological or psychiatric illness. And also, it's important because we're all taxpayers, and our tax money goes towards funding things like grants that fund my research, other people's research at Purdue. So it's good to know where your money is going, and it's also good to know what's happening outside of the classroom, so kind of the late-breaking research that is going on right now with neuroscience.
Now, I understand that this particular event is a lot more than just a dry academic study of the brain and the other problems. It's being entitled An Artful Tour of the Brain. Where does the art collections and all come into play here in this?
Well, Chris, this is Liz Burnell speaking. Mm-hmm. We have in our permanent collection, which is growing by leaps and bounds here at Purdue Northwest, we have in our collection some items that were donated by notable artists. And included in our display all of next week in LSF 144 will be works by Lee Tracy and Laura Jacobson. Mm-hmm. In addition, Professor Reagan has chosen some pieces from our permanent art collection which depict the senses, the five senses. And so we will have those up on easels too, in addition to the other cool thing that Professor Reagan is going to have erected on Tuesday, which I let her tell you about.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. So I'm really proud of what I'm calling the Brainitarium. And so this was done in collaboration with April Pooley, who is a neuroscientist at Michigan State, and also PhD candidates Zachary Grebe and Daniel Pfau, who are also at Michigan State. And what this is a giant 8-person tent that has been painted to look like a giant brain. Mm-hmm. And on the inside, we have Christmas lights that will be lit up depicting the different lobes, the different sections of the brain. And I'll be giving a tour of the brain every half hour, while all the other exhibits will be kind of ongoing. So that's sort of our largest piece and the part that I'm really most proud of.
We should mention, too, that that Professor Reagan is an assistant professor of psychology at Purdue University Northwest there at the Westfield campus. And so, obviously, she's academically trained in this sort of work, I suppose. And it's interesting that you should find a way to be able to explain the brain, its intricacy, and all the functions of it here to the average person, because it fits in very nicely with the STEM idea of education, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, neuroscience shouldn't only be communicated to other neuroscientists. You know, everybody should be able to understand the inner workings of the brain in layman's terms. So this is really catered to all ages. I've done tours for even kindergartners. So this really is catered to a wide audience, so everybody can appreciate neuroscience.
Liz, if you will, tell us a little bit more about the featured artist for the event all through the week here, Laura Jacobson.
Laura Jacobson is a noted artist. She has an exhibit ongoing at the New York University Langone Health Art Gallery, and that is going through March 31st of this year, and so we weren't able to get pieces of her ceramic exhibit, but we were able to receive prints, several of her prints. I work for Judy Jacoby, who's the Assistant Vice Chancellor of Art Collections and Special Programs, and when she heard that Christina was doing this program months ago, she got into high gear trying to procure art pieces to round out this exhibit, make it more fun, more interesting, more educational. And so Laura Jacobson is one of the two artists who we are featuring pieces from. Pardon my ending a sentence and a preposition. So Laura Jacobson has a Master of Fine Arts from the Rhode Island School of Design. She has a BA from Stanford University. She's worked as a journalist for San Francisco Bay Area newspapers before she began pursuing her lifelong passion for the visual arts. And her pieces that we have are all about the brain, naturally. We have 2D, we have prints of her 2D works on paper that depict 2D neurons and other innards of the brain, which I will let Dr. Reagan tell you about. Mm-hmm. And we also have four prints of her very, very cool ceramic depictions of slides of her own MRI. So we have four of those, and she made these ceramic pieces, which are on display in New York, and so we couldn't have those, out of clay, which is malleable like the brain. She has embedded gears and tools into the ceramic, and they make reference to the function, the data processing, and the structure of the brain, and how the brain, like clay, can be easily altered and molded. These are very, very colorful, very, very cool, and you can see intricate details of her MRI depicted in clay. Mm-hmm. So that is coming from Laura Jacobson.
There's another artist I understand named Lee Tracy who is also involved in this sort of work. How does Lee fit into the brain awareness exhibit that's happening there at Purdue Northwest Westville?
Well, Lee Tracy is a Chicago-based artist. She has her Bachelor of Fine Arts in Painting from the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. She has also attended the Milwaukee Institute of Art and Design and the Art Institute of Boston. She is noted for works on paper, for painting, for written novels and articles. And about 6 months ago, Lee Tracy donated to Purdue Northwest 35 light boxes. And these small light boxes are about 3 by 5 inches. Mm-hmm. They are backlit. They have a long cord, like a spinal cord. And in the light boxes, each one has a slide of her own MRI, and she has written thoughts from her own journal on each of the front slides of these MRIs. And we will have several of these light boxes on display for people to see. We will have a magnifying glass available if people want to get up closer and more personal with each of these. She's a very, very cool artist, and she's been involved in lots of things in the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. She's exhibited extensively in the United States and abroad.
And she was really the inspiration for this whole artful tour of the brain, because I met with Liz to actually pick out artwork for my own office, and I happened upon those light boxes. And I just thought, I've got a use for these. And that's how the whole collaboration really started, was combining neuroscience and art.
Now, in putting all this together here, obviously, it's very, very interesting. And I guess more so than you realize until you actually see everything all in one place here now. And getting things set up for the event on Tuesday, what kind of work have you had to do, I guess, there on campus to actually physically get this thing ready to go so that come Tuesday when the Brain Awareness Day happens, and, of course, the entire week there on campus focusing on this, that people get a chance to get the whole picture of what you're trying to say?
I have a whole army of volunteers ranging from undergraduates to faculty members, not only in psychology, but also in biology and chemistry, and people representing the Disability Access Center and the Counseling Center. So I first had to recruit people to help me out, because we've got about 16 different neuroscience-related demos, and I can't man them all. So I really have to thank the Honors College. A lot of students have signed up from the Honors College, from the Psychology Club at PNW, also the PsyChi organization, which is the Honor Society for Psychology, and then, of course, the people at the in the University Art Collections and the American Sign Language Club. So all of these people have come together, and they are running these demos and catered to their specialties.
Purdue University Northwest's Brain Awareness Day is coming up on Tuesday the 6th. And if you will, ladies, tell us where it's going to be, so if anybody wants to come over to campus in Westville and find it, they'll know where to look.
Sure. So it's located in LSF 144. And there's parking available all around campus, so you can park pretty much anywhere other than where it says Permit A only.
That's right.
And so it's from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., and we'll be having exhibits throughout that whole time with tours of the Brainatarium every half hour.
I would be remiss if I didn't mention the artist with whom I work very closely, who is not an employee of Purdue Northwest, but she is our very talented consultant. She's an installation specialist, and she has helped us all to put this together, to choose a variety of brain boxes, and we're going to be setting up for this. Her name is Michelle Weiser. She works on every aspect of our collections with me and with Judy Jacoby, who is the ringleader of our department, and Annie McDonald is our very capable assistant in the office.
That's Liz Burnell, who, along with Professor Christina Reagan, are working on the pieces of what will become Purdue University Northwest Brain Awareness Day, which is happening on Tuesday the 6th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. It'll be on the Westville campus in the Library Student Faculty Building in the gallery in room 144. And ladies, thank you very much for telling us about this. What an intriguing conversation that you could have about the brain and learning something new and showing that there are all kinds of components of what we learn about neuroscience that maybe fit in with other things, including art.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you for having us.
Thanks, Chris.
And Liz Burnell also reminds us that the Laura Jacobson exhibit will be on display all week long, Monday through Friday, in the gallery at the Westville campus. And it's all, of course, centered around Tuesday's Brain Awareness Day. IU Northwest will celebrate Women's History Month with an inspirational talk from IU Northwest alumna and NIPSCO executive Violet Sistoveras. She'll share her personal and professional reflections on climbing the corporate ladder over her 30-year career when she speaks on campus tomorrow evening at 5:30 in the Berglund Auditorium. IU Northwest officials say that during her talk, Sistoveras will offer some key lessons in leadership, personal growth, and career management, as well as some valuable lessons for both men and women at any stage of their career. At NIPSCO, Sistoveras is responsible for operations, regulatory policy, and compliance functions, while making sure that there's premier service delivery to the more than 1 million customers of NIPSCO across northern Indiana. The IU Northwest Alumni Board is sponsoring Violet Sistoveras' speech on March 6th, and it's free and open to the public, and a question and answer session and a reception will follow her presentation. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Finding and keeping affordable housing can turn into an ongoing battle for many Hoosiers. If the income's spent disproportionately on housing, that means less money spent on Hoosier food, education, and medical expenses. The Housing Choice Voucher Program, set up by the federal government, offers a way for individuals and families on the margins to be able to pay for rent and avoid eviction or even homelessness. In the first of a three-part series, Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Emily Seiberg tells us more about how families find themselves on the waiting list to be able to get those vouchers.
Subsidized housing is often referred to by the term Section 8. That refers to an amendment to the Housing Act of 1937 that authorizes housing assistance to low-income households. Those awarded housing choice vouchers pay 30% of their gross income towards housing costs, and the voucher covers the rest.
For many low-wage workers, their wages are just too low to afford the rental housing that's in the market without some type of assistance.
That's Andrew Arand, Vice President of Research at the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. His group estimates the housing wage required to pay rent and utilities in Indiana is $15.17 per hour, working 40 hours a week, 52 weeks a year. That's based on the average fair market rent for a two-bedroom apartment, $789. The minimum wage in Indiana, less than half that figure, $7.25 an hour. Housing vouchers can be used at any property a landlord agrees may participate in the program. Housing authorities ultimately assess a household's specific voucher needs based on household size and income. They can also apply what's called a preference, a way to filter and assess the waitlist in a more targeted way based on the area in which the housing authority is stationed. There are preferences for veterans, for those with disabilities, and for victims of domestic abuse, all groups whose earning options can be more limited. Greater Lafayette YWCA Domestic Violence Program Director Becky Wellner says the people with whom she works often lack the safety net of friends and family other households might have.
So many of our clients have not just one child, but lots of kiddos. And if they're not in school, then you're not only working a minimum wage job that is never going to be enough for you to pay your rent on your own, but then you also have to pay for childcare.
A 2016 study by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities found that 8% of Hoosiers utilizing vouchers were elderly, 22% had disabilities, and 3/4 were families with children. While some voucher households might be experiencing a moment of crisis that throws off their financial equilibrium and eventually subsides, like a divorce or a death in the family, some live in a chronic state of poverty that doesn't allow them to save money or make a plan. The National Low Income Housing Coalition's Andrew Arand says even a small change can upset a delicate financial balance.
And so what happens, of course, you know, is they're spending more than half of their income on rent. And then if there's an unexpected emergency, like say, you know, they need to get a car repair, or they have an unexpected medical bill, you know, it's very easy to fall behind on rent.
The Lafayette Housing Authority specifies income limits for applicants who fall into two categories: very low income and extremely low income. A one-person household in Tippecanoe County earning $13,150 annually is considered extremely low income. But according to data from the Lafayette Housing Authority, the average gross income of a household on the housing voucher waitlist is just $6,600.
Some of the public perception that people kind of engineer their lives so that they can qualify for rent assistance is incredibly uninformed.
Adam Murphy is the homeless outreach coordinator for the city of Lafayette.
If you were to organize your life so that you could receive rent assistance, you're saying no to so many good things on purpose, and that just doesn't add up.
Murphy manages housing assistance for people who are chronically homeless in conjunction with a mental health or substance abuse issue, or HIV and AIDS. On the spectrum of people battling housing insecurity, Murphy works with those whose barriers to stability mean they require help through every step of the housing process. But getting a voucher is also dependent on the system and can take time, in some cases, a long time. First, a city has to keep its waitlist open. Gary and Indianapolis have closed theirs due to high demand. Lafayette's is open, but families wait, on average, almost a year to receive their voucher. And that doesn't take into account the time spent waiting to apply for the voucher. The Lafayette Housing Authority accepts applications for just 2 hours per month, on the first Wednesday of every month, between 8 a.m. and 10 a.m. And getting on the list also requires bringing in documents, like Social Security cards and birth certificates, for every household member before the application is processed. The LHA's waitlist is currently 777 households long.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Seiberg.
Emily continues her series of reports here on Regionally Speaking tomorrow. For other states, it was just another Sunday, but as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, Hoosiers across Indiana yesterday commemorated a historic day by buying a bottle from a store that they usually don't visit on Sundays.
At 11:52 a.m., the first car pulls into the Village Bottle Shop on Sagamore Parkway in West Lafayette. It's 8 minutes until the liquor store opens its doors on a Sunday for the first time. Political analyst John Ketzenberger says the crowd assembling at this and other package stores is due to a cultural shift.
It took an agreement, basically, with all of the different retailers to say, sure, we'll open on Sunday for this to happen, because I think if that agreement hadn't occurred, we wouldn't be talking about Sunday sales.
As the clock struck noon, doors opened for the public. Manager Nathan Kukler said he expected to see a trickle of customers throughout the day.
Everyone knowing they have, you know, 8 hours to shop today for spirits and beer and whatnot. I think they'll just kind of mosey in as convenient for them.
Customers continued wandering in, including Janine Parsh, a lifelong Hoosier who says she's here to celebrate.
It's a historic day. I mean, who wouldn't want to come out and buy themselves some cold beer? You know, I mean, it's Sunday, the sun is shining. What more could you ask for?
Indiana Sunday sales ban started out with puritanical worry about the vices of booze. Over time, entrenched alcohol lobbies at the Statehouse became convinced it wasn't in their interest to change. Bills had been filed for years to try to change the law, failing over and over due to political pressure and messy legislative language. Political analyst Ketzenberger says this year's bill wasn't turned into a so-called Christmas tree, with amendments hanging on like unwanted ornaments that legislators could use as excuses not to change the law.
It would have been easy to lard it up with amendments and crush it, but they were able to get it through, and that was because there was a lot of legislative discipline on this particular bill.
Growing up in Indiana, customer Janine Parsh says she's used to buying beer ahead of time and doesn't see Sunday sales changing her schedule. But she appreciates knowing it's now an option.
It's nice to be able to not have those limitations on me so that if something would come up, I can do it. This is an antiquated law. It was silly, and I'm glad it's, you know, finally been put to rest.
That's also what lawmakers appeared to finally realize last Wednesday when Governor Eric Holcomb signed the bill. The Hoosiers want convenience, and previous concerns about flooding the state with alcohol seem overblown. Ketzenberger agrees.
As far as a big bump in sales or that kind of thing, I think that economically it's probably going to be a pretty flat situation. I don't think you're going to see a lot more consumption.
To mark the special day, Parsh decided to change things up in her purchase.
I went for this Consecrator Doppelbach beer. I'm normally a dark beer lover. I like myself a good Bell's Porter, but I thought I'd try something a little different today since this is such a historic occasion.
There's more discussion to come about whether more than just liquor stores may sell cold beer, for instance. But on Sunday, Hoosiers found the state's ability to change at all a move worth raising a glass to. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
By the way, the Associated Press reports that the Nick's Liquors chain here in Northwest Indiana chose to stay closed on Sundays, with company officials there saying that they didn't expect a big jump in sales if they had opened on Sundays. This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and in studio we have our Northwest Indiana political activist, Ruth Needleman. Ruth, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's a pleasure to be back. It's been quite some time.
I know it has. Well, there have been a lot of things happening, especially here within the last 2 or 3 weeks here.
Absolutely.
And bring us up to date on how these events have happened and what's coming up.
Well, there's been quite a few, but let me start with my key campaign, which is the deportations at the Gary Airport. Now, this has been going on for over 11 years, and I wrote to the new director of the airport in the middle of February saying, hey, we have a protest coming up. I would like to have a meeting with you. He wrote me back at 7 p.m. the night before the protest.
Do you think that maybe your email got lost in a pile of others?
No, he apologized, but then he claimed that he read about the protest in the paper when obviously he had read about it in my email. But when I got there, I think I reported last time I had never seen so many cops in my life in Gary. But that was wrong because I saw more this time. They had SWAT teams, I think, from everywhere. I thought I was in Vietnam. They had everything on them. And so I got there. I pulled up in our little, they close us into the parking lot. I parked my car and hobbled out because I fell down my steps. I hobble. And said, I need to meet with the director of the airport. And the cop said, you cannot leave the parking lot. And then escorted me back in. And he was like, before, twice my size. I'm sure I was very intimidating, but my question is, so many armed TAC squad folks, who are they protecting and what are they afraid of? Because we were once again extremely peaceful. We had a great turnout, about 250 people in freezing weather. We seemed to bring on the cold.
Mm-hmm.
At this time, they had brought in snowplow equipment to block our view. And so they lock us in the parking lot, and then they pull trucks and big earth movers to make sure we can't see what's happening. And that leads me to believe that they must know that what they're doing is shameful, because the number of deportations is increasing at our airport. The number of vehicles is increasing. And even though it was peaceful, they are getting us quite angry. We had one fellow in his 50s who drove 3 hours to come. They would not let him leave the parking lot to go to the bathroom. That is inexcusable. Very inexcusable, and I plan to take it up at the city council. So anybody out there who has some spare time and wants to give me a hand, because we have what's called a pact with Chicago that says that our airport can only serve as a reliever to O'Hare and Midway, which means we can relieve them of doing the dirty work of deportations, because O'Hare used to do them. Now it's all out of Gary. And how many jobs have we created with the deportations? Not a single one, because they come with, they're accompanied by McHenry County sheriffs from Illinois, and the airplane comes in from Brownsville and goes back to Brownsville, and nobody gets a job. And a year ago from our protest, there was a meeting at the airport where they promised within days we would have passenger service. And 365 days passed, and there is not a single passenger flight. And I think it's because of this pact, because I think Southwest was interested in coming to Gary. And the Chicago administration said, if you go to Gary, you won't go out of Midway, which, of course, nobody could afford to do. So we are still scrambling for job-creating opportunities at the airport.
Somebody trying to reach you.
Yes.
Maybe somebody wants to help you out on that
I know,
that
but
tack that you,
I
tack
managed
you got
to get
with
it
the city
off
council.
Before
yes.
It was too bad. So we are planning. We have a conference call, as a matter of fact, tonight to decide a strategy for the airport, meetings with the airport director, meetings with the Jet Center, and see if we can't get the city council to demand jobs instead of deportations. So that will be an ongoing battle. We had a bus from Chicago. We had unions there. The steelworkers had an A. Philip Randolph Black Labor Week going on, and they brought all their folks over to the airport. So despite whatever, we're growing, and more people know about us.
And we know, too, that the city of Gary is getting ready to initiate a citywide comprehensive plan and have meetings all across the city with organizations. And I would imagine that your particular organization, the one that you work with, should be one of the groups that the community leaders and other people should be talking to.
I hope so. Mm-hmm. Because one of the problems, they're doing a big expansion and a redoing of the runway at the airport. And my question is, as it was years ago, will you hire any Gary residents to do that work? Last time, I have a friend who's an operating engineer. She worked 4 hours at the Gary airport. She's a Black woman, operating engineer. 4 hours is all she got. And we were out picketing, of course, Indiana University's new building, which they managed to put up for $45 million without hiring a single person from Gary. And so we're not done with demanding local hiring. And certainly that would be central to anything the city hopes to do in a long-term plan, because if we don't hire people in Gary, the money is not spent in Gary. And in the end, the best we get is gentrification, but we certainly don't get a revival of our communities.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana political activist Ruth Needleman. We've heard here recently about the ICE visit to the airport again and the protest that went along, too. What other projects have you been working on and coming up here?
Well, I have a little announcement to make, which is tomorrow in East Chicago at the Pastrick Library at 1008 Chicago Avenue. The EPA is holding a public hearing on the DuPont cleanup. Now, EPA has been asking them to clean up their toxic land. It has been nearly 100 years of destroying the ecosystem and poisoning people, and they have found every which way not to clean up. So they're at this meeting. We're calling on activists to come from all over the region because DuPont occupies 440 acres of highly contaminated land in East Chicago. The property is bounded to the south by the East Branch of the Calumet River and residential and commercial areas. Mm-hmm. So this will be a very important meeting. Let me check the time. At 6 p.m. at the public library in East Chicago.
Yeah, on Chicago Avenue.
That's right. Got another announcement.
Yes.
This is my project again. Sorry to be so active, but I can't help it. This is an exhibit, but not your usual kinds of exhibits. It's called The Art of Resistance and Resilience in Northwest Indiana. And it is being hosted by a gallery in Chicago. And we put this exhibit up on Saturday, and you would not believe the variety of materials. We have famous artists in this. We have, oh, I'm so bad with names. So, for example, we have the stencils that the Calumet Artist Residency's Poetry Project used. Mm-hmm. We will be stenciling the sidewalk outside the gallery. And we also have Kay Rosen, who has exhibited all over the country. And we have Corey Hegelberg, whose wood prints are fabulous. And he is exhibiting his brand new one called The Birth of Ecology. We also have banners and posters. We have a huge pipeline snake hanging from the ceiling whose head is a double skeleton. It is remarkable. We have photographs from our demonstrations. We will have poetry readings. And we will have three short films, perhaps four, on the airport, on the Calumet Lives Matter struggle, on the BP struggle against the poisoning of BP with its tar sands processing. We will have all kinds of events. It is at the Uri Eichen Gallery. That is URI hyphen Eichen, EICHEN. It is on the corner of 21st and Halsted in the Pilsen neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And there will be food, there will be drinks, and there will be performance, poetry, music, and who knows what else will show up.
You mentioned the Calumet Poetry Group. That group, for people in Northwest Indiana may not be familiar, they are the ones that about a year or more ago went ahead and took advantage of the opportunity to help some school students and other people in the neighborhoods around some of the closed Gary Community Schools to, on the boarded up walls and windows, put up some poetry. And
that's
where a lot of the poets in Northwest Indiana had a chance to show off their work for that project. And also, too, they've been helping out in other ways, too. For example, at the closed and hopefully to be preserved Gary Power and Light Building.
That's right. And those stencils will either be on the walls or we will be stenciling those poems on the streets of Chicago. So it'll be a very exciting evening. It goes from 6 to 10. That's March 9th, this Friday, in the Pilsen area. Great food around there, but we'll also have food and wine. And we invite everyone to come take part. There are many other things, a lot of environmental issues that have been happening. Our state senator, Eddie Melton, has been the best listener I think we've ever had in the state Senate. Mm-hmm. While he signed on to introduce the bill that would have allowed for a landfill with toxic materials within 600 feet of homes, he also withdrew it. After listening to the people, he said, I sponsored it so I could keep my fingers on it. And when the people stood up and said, we do not think that that is a good thing to do anywhere, let alone in Gary, that has toxic dumps everywhere. There was also a very exciting meeting last Thursday night. where they were talking with Maya Energy, mm-hmm. who wants to put yet another place. They don't want to call it a landfill or a dump, but they want to take toxic materials from demolition and put it right next to a school. And what's interesting is this, like the issue of guns, was taken over by the students. The students basically stood up, denounced it, and would not stand down. And I think that what we are seeing is the rebirth of social movements because high school students and the young are literally up in arms against arms mm-hmm. across the country. There was a demonstration at the gun show in Southlake. It has been a very busy period of time. And with all the plans for, excuse me, for building, I think we really have to begin to bear down on the issue of local hiring. Mm-hmm. We have a local hiring ordinance in Gary. And yet, Marquette Park, the airport, the university building in Gary, none of those took advantage of hiring and training. All of them promised money for training, and none of them did any. And so our most disparaged zip zones, where the poorest people live, are not getting trained, they're not getting jobs. And I do believe that the strategy is to push the African-American communities out of Gary, like they're doing in Chicago and Detroit, so they can gentrify. And our communities are historic. I think we know that Gary was the first city in the country, along with Cleveland, to have a black mayor, Mayor Richard Hatcher. We are trying to get a civil rights museum built because it was the home of the first National Political Caucus. It also was the birthplace of the ad hoc committee of black steelworkers that brought about a very significant change in the composition of leadership in the Steelworkers Union. And so we really need to preserve our history, and that means preserving our communities and not replacing them with people who have more money and who complain about, and this is quite true, we see it all the time on our neighborhood watch, people complain about black people walking down the streets in Miller. That is unacceptable. Now, hopefully, our art exhibit will travel to Miller and to Gary. We know it will be in May in Hammond, Indiana, but you won't want to miss the opening, folks.
Ruth, thank you very much for spending some time with us today to talk about the projects that have happened, one's coming up here. We've been having a Northwest Indiana political activist Ruth Needleman in the studio to bring us up to date, and we hope to have you back soon.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope to see people out there in the struggles.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Urban League of Northwest Indiana holds its 6th annual Diversity and Inclusion Awards Luncheon on March 22nd in Merrillville. And President and CEO of the Urban League, Dr. Vanessa McLeod, was with us here on Regionally Speaking to talk about the award categories for 2018.
The categories are a community award that's presented to an organization or group that actively supports activities and services which engage diverse citizens out in the community. You have your leadership award on a local and regional level. The workforce diversity award is presented to an organization that implements innovative strategies to attract and select and promote and maintain a more diverse and inclusive workforce. Now, we have the Moving the Needle award. We have a youth award, because there's a number of youth groups that are in the community throughout Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties. And those are the target areas that we serve, Chris. I'm not sure sometimes mm-hmm. if people are aware of that, that we serve Lake, Porter. So any organization in Lake, Porter, and LaPorte County can apply for any one of these awards. And they can do that by going online and pulling down the application and completing it and sending that in.
Mm-hmm. Besides these awards here, there's obviously also a Lifetime Achievement Award, and that's one I know that probably was one of those awards that probably draws the most attention because it brings people that have been working very hard in service of African Americans and other groups in Northwest Indiana over the years, and it certainly recognizes them. And so I'm sure that's one of those awards that you probably get a number of applications for, saying, "Hey, I know this person. That person would be perfect to be able to be a recipient of this award."
And you know what? That is so true, Chris. And believe it or not, it's not all about the African Americans that are receiving these awards. There are other ethnic groups that receive these awards. For instance, the leadership award last year went to a judge in LaPorte County, Judge Thomas Alvazo. He received the leadership award. Now, the Lifetime Achievement Award went to one of our historic leaders, and I'm sure you're familiar with him. And that was the first African-American mayor that was elected to an office, and that was former Mayor Richard Gordon Hatcher.
Right.
So we've received a number of applications for many of these awards. Just to give you an idea, for instance, Horizon Bank won the Community Relations Award in 2014. Majestic Star Casino won the Community Relations in 2015. There is a retired senior volunteer program of Porter County. Valparaiso University won the Workforce Award. And then we had our Indiana Dunes, the National Lakeshore, which sometimes people don't even think about, and the diversity that they have in their organization. So these are just a few, like the Mental Health of America of Lake County. Mm-hmm. They won the worst. So there's many opportunities for agencies, corporations, nonprofits, youth to apply for these awards and submit them. We would love to have your applications. Mm-hmm. Yes.
One of the awards I know that is up here on the categories this year, as it has in the past, is the Workforce Diversity Award. Can you tell us what organizations seem to have won the past awards and how they got involved in being recognized for what they do just as a business?
Well, in 2013, that was our first year, Valparaiso University won. And then in 2014, there was Excellence by Design. And 2015, there was the Mental Health America of Lake County.
Right.
Now, I would think that those persons who thought about what they were doing in the community, not only that, but what they were doing on their jobs. It says that this award looks at organizations that implement innovative strategies to attract, select, and promote and maintain a more diverse and inclusive workforce. So that's looking at your HR. That's looking at how are you reaching out to say that we are an organization that wants to promote diversity, and we're going to do the extra that we need to take to make sure that that happens, whether it's a Latino, Asian, whoever it is. These are some of the organizations that put a package together and submitted that application. And the application is simple. It's probably only 2 or 3 pages long.
Right.
You know, you just give us some background about what you're doing. Now, we know, Chris, that there is no perfect organization. But what we do know is there are some organizations out there that are really making some efforts towards diversity. And we want to highlight them. We want to talk about them. We want to acknowledge them. The Moving the Needle Award is for nominees that show an exceptional effort in all 3 categories. They talk about their workforce, they talk about what they're doing in the community, and they talk about what they're doing in terms of leadership. And we have had one recipient of that, and that was the Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore. Those are the ones who actually won that particular year. Now, there may be some others who were eligible to win, but they didn't apply for the award.
Uh-huh.
They applied for, say, the workforce, or they applied for the leadership. So So I would like people to know and organizations to know you can apply for all of the awards. You're not limited just for one. You can apply for the moving the needle as well as the leadership. You can apply for the workforce as well as the community if you can demonstrate in your application how you meet the criteria of these awards.
More information about the Diversity and Inclusion Awards is on the Urban League of Northwest Indiana's website, and you can also go there to make reservations for the upcoming luncheon. It's time for another edition of Eye on the Arts, and here's John Kane of South Shore Arts.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is Phil Bauman, music director of the LaPorte County Symphony Orchestra. And Phil, you have a concert coming up?
Yes, we do. Hi, John. Hi. Thank you for having me on the program.
Sure.
This coming Sunday in Michigan City, the symphony is going to be doing a program called Fantasia, and this is going to be at the Holdcraft Performing Arts Center, formerly known as the Elston Theater in Michigan City, at 3 p.m., and we're going to have an orchestra program that features music of Korngold, of Peter Boyer, Arthur Sullivan, and some British sea songs. I have to say that very carefully.
Yes, exactly.
That's a tongue twister. So this is our classical concert of the season, and we're gonna round it off with some Irish songs being sung by the audience and the orchestra, since we're getting really close to St. Patrick's Day. So it's a great program for us, and it's going to be a real delight for our audience, I think.
Well, first of all, I've never heard of this Holdcraft Performing Arts Center. It's not where you usually perform.
Actually, it is.
Oh, okay.
Stan Holdcraft used to be the used to run that facility and has been a real strong supporter of the arts in Michigan City all these years. And so when he retired, they officially renamed it, I think it was last year.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's the same Elston Performing Arts Center where they do all the plays and the musicals and stuff Michigan City. But
okay. And how did you come up with the theme for this concert?
Well, a couple of things. This year's season theme has been one of tales of adventure. So thinking about stories, and I've always had an affinity for British and Irish music. And so we started to wrap it up with the Korngold's music, Much Ado About Nothing, Shakespeare, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then the British sea songs are all songs of British history and lore. And then The Dream Lives On is a piece by Peter Boyer, which talks about excerpts speeches by the Kennedy brothers. And so there's some very interesting reminiscences there. And so this British-Irish connection. And then I discovered, after I had already planned this, that I always wanted to know where I came from. So I went to 23andMe.
Oh, is that something you can spit into?
Yeah, exactly. So I discovered through the process of this that I was 100% heritage from Central European, and the highest percentage of that was 23% British.
Huh.
I'm like, well, that's why I love this music.
Uh-huh.
Must be somewhere out in my genes somewhere that this really has really spoken to me over these years. And so when I was like, well, there's sort of an affirmation of why this music interests me a lot. But
that's nice.
It was kind of cool revelation there.
I haven't spat yet.
Oh.
I haven't.
You don't have to, you know.
No, I got it for Christmas, but I haven't spat. I keep putting it up. Somebody I know who is the least likely human being alive to have been related to Marie Antoinette was allegedly related to Marie Antoinette. I don't know how they can tell that.
Right. You know, there's some gene pools that...
All right. Back to the concert. So Arthur Sullivan. This is our favorite Arthur Sullivan of Gilbert and Sullivan fame.
Right. And as I was researching this and trying to find something that might be interesting, I realized he wrote a symphony symphony. Only wrote one, and absolutely nobody has ever heard it. All the musicians are going, "What the heck is this piece?" It's great. It's fun music, but they've never played it. And so I think for the listener, they're going to be really surprised that this composer had a lot of great classical training in Germany, and great teachers had this aptitude to write really serious music. And they're going to hear, because of the time it was written in, which is around 1866, before the 1900s, you're going to hear a little bit of Brahms, a little bit of Dvorak, Colors of Smetana. He was very influenced by Mendelssohn. So he nicknamed it the Irish Symphony because these melodies came to him when he was on a vacation in Ireland. So that's the connection. But it's going to be a fun concert.
And you're dedicating the Much Ado About Nothing
to
Jerry McCleary.
My dear friend Jerry McCleary, who I've always considered as Grandma Jerry.
Uh-huh.
She loved the orchestra. Had been with, so here's that 23andMe again. She had been with the orchestra for 23 years. And then she donated some funds to us so that we could have a a great concert, and so we're dedicating this
piece
to her.
She was so nice to me when South Shore Arts first took over the management of the Northwest Indiana Symphony.
She loved the arts. She loved she played with the Northwest Indiana Symphony as a musician, too. So.
And I understand that these last two concerts with the LaPorte County Symphony are going to be especially meaningful for you and your audience.
Yeah, I think so. These are going to be the last two concerts that I conduct with them. I'm going to be stepping down at the end of this season, so we're looking to have some great memories together and encouraging the audience to come and witness this magic and be a part of this for our last two concerts. And it's been 23 years that I've been with that orchestra, so it's been a great ride. And as the millennials say, I'm going to take a gap year. I'm not quite sure what the next year is going to be, but I'm looking forward to having some little extra time on my hands.
You can hike through Central Europe and find your ancestral
whatever. I'll find the Baumans over there in Germany somewhere.
Okay. All right, Phil. Well, thanks for being here to tell us about this upcoming concert, and thank you for listening. We'll be back again next week with another edition of Eye on the Arts.
You can catch other Eye on the Arts conversations, as well as this one, on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for being with us, and we hope you'll join us tomorrow.